Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wiser. Since 2018, we've been telling the life stories of women surgeons and sharing advice for the next generation of diverse, forward-thinking, problem-solving surgeon leaders. I'm Megan Wasson, a fourth-year medical student at Emory University School of Medicine and Wiser co-president. I'm joined today by Rachel Holstein.
Hi, I'm Rachel, a third-year medical student and Wiser VP.
And today we're honored to have Dr. Jennifer Kwas with us on the podcast. Among her numerous roles and responsibilities, she serves as the Division Director of Reproductive Endocrinology at Emory University and Director of the Emory Reproductive Center. Dr. Kwas obtained her undergraduate degree at Davidson College, where she split her time between studies and a Division I sport. She went on to medical school in her home state of Virginia at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and found her way to Atlanta for residency and fellowship training. She's received many accolades along the way, including her role as chief resident and guest researcher for the CDC, as well as current engagements at the national level with the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. We're honored to have Dr. Kwas with us today and look forward to hearing more about her work in REI.
Welcome, Dr. Kwas. Thank you so much for being here. To start us off, why don't you go ahead and tell us about yourself?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to meet with both of you. So I am originally from Virginia, or I spent most of my life in Virginia. I'm the daughter of two immigrants from Lebanon, actually. So I'm a first-generation American. I, as you mentioned, went to a K-12 school in Virginia Beach and then graduated and ended up playing Division I field hockey at Davidson College. Never really expected myself to go to a small liberal arts school in the South, but I will say it was a very formative 4 years that sort of was a springboard for the career trajectory of the rest of my life that I didn't really appreciate at the time, probably. I then went to UVA for medical school, where I met my now husband, and we did couples match. He matched into general surgery and I matched into OBGYN at Emory. And over the course of the subsequent 10 years, we each did residency and fellowship at Emory in Atlanta. I stayed on as faculty after finishing. My husband joined the plastics and reconstructive surgery division. And we have been in Atlanta ever since. Never really expected when we moved in 2007 that we would still be here in 2024. But there are so many wonderful things about the city and the institution that we have stayed.
I know Rachel and I are certainly appreciative that you ended up staying because we've benefited so much from your teaching. Let's pause here briefly for our listeners who may be new to REI. Per the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, REI is a surgical subspecialty of obstetrics and gynecology that focuses on the hormones and control mechanisms that regulate reproduction, sexual function, and sexual development. Reproductive endocrinologists diagnose and treat endocrine disorders that are related to reproduction. These treatments range from medications that induce ovulation to egg retrievals, embryo transfers, and in vitro fertilization, or IVF, to name just a few. Now that we're all up to speed, I'm wondering, Dr. Kwas, for our next question, if you can tell us a little bit more about how you decided OBGYN, and more specifically, reproductive endocrinology.
Of course. So I grew up in Virginia Beach, which is in very close proximity to Norfolk, Virginia, which is where the first IVF baby in the United States was born. Those of you that don't have a strong interest in REI may or may not know, but the first IVF baby in the United States was born in 1981 at a place called the Jones Institute. And interestingly enough, my dad was the practice administrator at the Jones Institute. And so I had very early exposure to IVF and to patients traveling from all over the world to come to the Jones Institute for care. And whether I knew it or not, probably influenced me in ways that I wasn't aware of at the time. I went into medical school with an open mind, not really knowing what I wanted to do, and went through that same trajectory of, do I want a field that has procedure, no procedure? And then once I've decided procedure, do I want to go into general medicine and pick a subspecialty that has procedure, or women's health and OB? And I am one of those reproductive endocrinologists that chose OBGYN knowing that I ultimately wanted to be a fertility specialist. And I'm drawn to the field, I think, for a lot of reasons. Some of them are social, emotional. Some of them are more academic. Socially, emotionally, I love the fact that we get to spend a lot of time with our patients, that we get to know individuals oftentimes very well and have a partnership that lasts relatively long over the course of their entire reproductive years, and that we have the opportunity to make a very concrete change and influence the trajectory of the rest of their lives when we're able to help people build families. So that's a social emotional part of it. From a more medical physiologic perspective, I am one of those people that really finds the pathways and the feedback loops and the science behind reproductive endocrinology really satisfying. We also do a lot of procedures that are efficient and effective, which I find also very satisfying. So it honestly checked all the boxes. And I tell medical students all the time, I actually love my job. It has an incredible mix of patient care and longevity in terms of relationships with patients. I'm now getting old enough that my patients' kids are quite old, but they still send me Christmas cards or holiday cards or birthday emails. And that's pretty powerful. I also love the intersection of this field with ethics. And from a national perspective, I think this field is really young and there's so much room for research and there's so much room for having a seat at the table in terms of the direction that the field goes from an ethical perspective and now increasingly also from a perspective of advocacy. So there's always something interesting and exciting happening in the field, and it's a pleasure to be part of that.
I love hearing sort of the reflection of early on having that interest in IVF instilled, and then just hearing about how rewarding the career's been for you. And then just to step back a little bit and give our listeners a bit of a background on some of your day-to-day responsibilities. Would you be willing to talk a little bit more about that?
So I am an academic REI, which means that I have a few different hats that I wear. One is predominantly clinical care, which involves seeing patients in clinic, which since the pandemic, we now do both in person and virtually over telemedicine. It involves doing outpatient surgical procedures, hysteroscopy, laparoscopy, most of the time with the goal of optimizing chance of future conception. And it involves doing IVF procedures like egg retrievals and embryo transfers. And it involves managing fertility cycles. So patients that are undergoing either intrauterine insemination cycles or IVF cycles, managing their progress as they move through a cycle. So that takes up, honestly, the majority of my time. But because of my other sort of academic and division director hats, I also spend some time doing research. I spend some time teaching medical students, residents, and fellows, and I spend some time doing service, which is either like at the institutional level and also at the national level. There's a lot of variety, which is another thing that I like.
Yeah, it keeps it interesting. Our next question is specifically about the patient population that you usually treat. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the type of patients that seek your care.
Yeah, the population of individuals that come to a fertility clinic are potentially more varied and diverse than one might expect. The traditional patient population that one might think of is a heterosexual couple that has had trouble conceiving that comes to see us. And that certainly is a large proportion of the patients that we spend time helping. There are also patients that have recent medical diagnoses that might warrant discussion about fertility preservation because of the impact of their medical treatment on their future fertility. There are patients that have congenital anomalies that might warrant an intervention. There are patients that have primary amenorrhea that may never have had a cycle that come to see us when they're not yet trying to conceive. There are also patients in same-sex relationships, transgender patients that are single, aiming to grow. their family without a partner, their patients with genetic conditions that don't have infertility that are doing IVF to prevent passing on a genetic condition to their offspring. So the scope, I think, has actually grown with time.
That definitely sounds like a wide variety of reasons to come see you. As a follow-up to that, how do your patients generally find out about REI?
Oftentimes, they're referred by a general OBGYN. Increasingly, it is by word of mouth from other friends. And we're in an era now where I think we can't deny the fact that social media and things like this podcast influence patients and the public sort of knowledge about what treatment options exist. So some traditional avenues and then increasingly more non-traditional ways of learning about what care exists.
Yeah, and diving deeper into that, you mentioned the role of social media. And I know personally, I've seen lots of ads on Facebook and Instagram. I'm wondering, do you have any concerns about how social media influences the decision-making process accessing REI?
Such a great question. It is a challenging situation, I think, in that it's a double-edged sword, right? Like education and access and having more and more people understand the prevalence of infertility, removing stigma from infertility, normalizing family building and fertility preservation for as broad and heterogeneous a group of patients as possible is fantastic. But there's also room for a lot of data to get shared that is not necessarily founded in science or evidence. And so this sort of propagation of facts or so-called facts that are not necessarily founded in science are dangerous. I think we see this, though it's not unique to the field of medicine. Unfortunately, it is just a new issue that has arisen.
Could you touch a little bit more on what myths you think should be dispelled?
ASRM has actually tried to launch an educational campaign on this topic. The fact that ovarian reserve decreases with age is an important fact that is sometimes minimized or made to not garner attention. The fact that infertility is very prevalent and that it's not anyone's fault or the result of any action that they've taken or not taken is an important fact that I think is not always publicized. The benefits of things like egg freezing are maybe sometimes overblown in such a way that it's so important just for a patient to have a conversation with a reproductive endocrinologist that is board certified that can give them facts and data that are specific to their situation. I think anything that's a generalization is tricky, right? Because it doesn't necessarily apply to each individual. And so every patient's situation is unique, and having someone who's been trained to understand all the facts, all the data, and then help apply them to that particular patient situation is going to be more accurate than any global blanket statement.
That absolutely seems to be the case. There are so many challenges to disseminating health education out there, and I do think social media can be a force for good, as well as a force that perpetuates some of these myths. We were doing a bit of our own research specifically on age, which, as you mentioned, is something that can be glossed over in online sources. And according to the CDC National Vital Statistics reports, the average age of first birth for mothers was a record high of 27.4 years in 2022. Compared to prior years, birth rates rose the most for those ages 25 to 29 and 35 to 49, and declined for females ages 15 to 24. So individuals like ourselves in intensive professional program likely fall into this older age bucket and may delay childbearing even beyond these data points. What options do these patients have for growing their families?
Yeah, I think there is a clear growing amount of data that the age of first live birth in the United States is increasing. It's also true in a lot of other developed countries around the globe. And we've also noticed, if you look at the national vital statistics, that there are more and more women in their 40s having children than there used to be. It's actually a pretty dramatic increase over the last decade or so. And on average, patients in the U.S. undergoing IVF are in their mid-30s. So they're still young is such a relative term, but they're still relatively young. As someone ages, their options certainly do change in a fertility clinic, and the likelihood of success with fertility treatment is primarily dependent on one's age at the time of the egg retrieval. And that is just a function of human biology, right? And the rate of non-disjunction that increases as maternal age increases. And there's only so much that we can overcome. There are options as women get older and older that include things like donor egg and donor embryo and obviously adoption. But the majority of the patients that we see are still in an age range where they can use their own eggs.
And I'm wondering too, you mentioned that a lot of your patients are getting older, but ultimately in the grand scheme of things, they're very young. It's just older in the sense of having children. And I'm wondering how that conversation goes and what are some of the things that you talk to your patients about when they come in and they're so afraid of this age, but in the grand scheme of things, they're young and healthy otherwise.
Yeah. The conversation is harder when women are actually in their mid to late 40s and feel young. And we have to have a hard conversation about how they feel young, but their ovaries are biologically old. That is a conversation probably that we have more often than not. Although it's considered an advanced maternal age pregnancy if someone delivers when they're 35 or older, more often than not, I do not find that those patients are necessarily nervous about getting pregnant in their late 30s with their own eggs.
Just pivoting a little bit, we know in many other areas of medicine, insurance coverage is often a topic of conversation. And we know that's the case in REI as well, and that there might be some unique challenges when it comes to this particular field. We were wondering if you would be willing to discuss some of the financial barriers that patients might experience when they're seeking out your services.
Absolutely. So I actually published an article on this topic a few years ago, and we titled it something to the effect of the fact that family building and fertility care should be considered a human right. And there are, I believe at the time we published the article, there were 17 states and now there are 19 states that have mandates in place to cover fertility services. But these mandates are incredibly heterogeneous and sort of the carve outs and what they cover and don't cover vary pretty significantly from one state to another. As y'all know, in the United States, most insurance is employer-based. And there are a growing number of companies that provide coverage and also third-party insurers that have now adjuncts that employers can partner with to provide coverage. It's one of the many areas of potential room for improvement in the United States healthcare system. It is a process that can be very expensive, and it is something that a lot of national organizations are putting a lot of time and energy into trying to improve, but there is continued room for improvement. It has improved dramatically, I will say, over the past decade, but that does not mean that it's solved.
Absolutely. I think it's wonderful to hear about all of the work that people in REI are doing to try and overcome this barrier, which can be a really significant barrier for a lot of people seeking your care. I also know that you've done a lot of advocacy here at Emory regarding insurance coverage. I'm wondering if you could speak more to that work, maybe even touching on some of the advocacy you've done for medical trainees for insurance coverage.
Yeah, so we made a push that Emory employees have $25,000 of fertility coverage that can be used toward any fertility treatment, including IVF. And this is something that took a fair amount of time and energy to move forward. It was a team effort. And I think it has made a big difference in terms of access to care for employees of all sorts that work at Emory, including residents and physicians, also all staff and employees. It has, I think, opened the door in many ways in terms of allowing or improving access to fertility services. It would be nice if more and more employers and institutions improved their coverage of fertility services and realized that in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the cost of other things that are often covered, while an IVF cycle is incredibly expensive when an individual is paying out of pocket, if you consider the cost to an insurance company compared to a lot of other medical interventions that we have, it is relatively small.
It's so inspiring to hear the advocacy that you've done, both for patients, but also for residents. We're wondering if you had any advice for us as medical trainees, as if there's anything that you think we could do to advocate to help people afford the services.
That's a great question. I think some of it is related to, at your local institutional level, any sort of consortium or group organization that brings awareness to the fact that there may be a lapse in coverage or a desire for coverage that doesn't exist. Just realizing that fertility care is not something that's necessarily elective, which it's sometimes deemed or termed. I half joke, but nobody wants to be my patient, right? Just the same way nobody wants to be an oncologist's patient. Nobody wants to need help building their family. So it's not elective in the same way that some other procedures might be deemed elective. And the more awareness we can bring to that fact, the better.
And going off of that, I think sometimes we as medical trainees and also just the larger population might not realize how many people need these services. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that piece of it and dispel the myth of this being something that isn't used frequently.
So probably 2% of all births in the US now are the result of an IVF pregnancy. And we estimate that about 15% of reproductive age couples have infertility. And there's even a recent JAMA study that suggested that as high as 1 in 4 physician couples or physicians may suffer from infertility, partly due to the delay that is associated oftentimes with childbearing in individuals that have a medical career.
We've talked a lot about finances in general, but are there, outside of finances, other barriers that your patients face that you feel are unique to REI? For example, we know that some of these can be time-intensive treatments, the psychological toll, or any others that you can think of.
Certainly. I think there are stigma-related barriers still. I think there's still some element of both male and female patients feeling some degree of fault or blame when they have infertility, even though someone may not feel that way if they had thyroid disease or some other medical condition. I think there is a tremendous amount of psychological stress that comes along with this care and treatment, a large part of which is a function of the fact that despite all the energy and effort that anyone puts into the care or treatment, there's no guarantee that it will work. And so it is a lot of emotional and financial investment without a guaranteed outcome. And then it's also time consuming, right? So if someone is working full time or has other responsibilities, it's time sensitive appointments and interventions that are hard. It's very hard to be a fertility patient.
It does sound like there's just a tremendous psychological piece to all of this. Could you speak more to some of the ways in which patients cope with this strain? I know support persons can look really different for people, and I'm wondering if you have any insight that you could offer about that piece of it.
Yeah, I think we, as physicians, number one, discuss the psychological stressors and don't just ignore them. So not assuming anything. So I often have that exact conversation with patients, like, this is not your fault. This is not the result of anything you did or didn't do. You don't need to walk on eggshells to make this work. We often provide a list of individuals in the psych world, psychologists, therapists, counselors, psychiatrists that have expertise in this field specifically, and encourage patients, normalize having someone that they can talk to. For some people, that is a licensed professional. For some people, that's encouraging them to be open with their friends or their family or even at work so that they don't feel like they're bearing the burden alone. As you said, everybody copes with stress in different ways, but trying to help people realize that it's normal to feel stressed and that it's reasonable to take active action to try to mitigate that stress.
Great. Great to hear all the effort being put into taking care of the patient as a whole. Last question about patients is, what advice would you have for people who are thinking about seeing a reproductive endocrinologist? Or what qualities should they look for in a practice?
I would start by saying not to be shy or scared to reach out, that almost all reproductive endocrinologists are really nice and warm and really just want to meet people where they are and help them. I would also say that you would want to look for someone who underwent full board certified training, right? So you want someone who did a full OBGYN residency and also completed 3 years of fellowship and is either board eligible or boarded.
Thinking more broadly beyond individual level care, I remember you talking about how the first IVF baby was born in 1981, which in the grand scheme of things is not that long ago. I'm wondering, in your opinion, what are the things that you expect to change in the future in REI?
We certainly have continued room to grow in terms of understanding embryo potential better and knowing which embryo is most or least likely to implant. Improving understanding of unexplained infertility, of recurrent pregnancy loss. There's still a lot of unknowns where there is room for tremendous amount of scientific breakthrough and progress in terms of patients that even with our current treatment are not successful.
And what would you say you are most excited about in REI?
I think of all the roles that I hold, other than the sort of day-to-day clinical care, I really still enjoy, honestly, spending time with patients and getting to know patients and helping patients at the face-to-face, one-on-one level. On a national level, I really enjoy my role on the ethics committee. And it is a role that is constantly evolving and continues to remain relevant and I think will always be relevant. I'm not sure that I truly enjoy having to be politically active, but I am realizing that is another hat that I have to put on for the sake of maintaining access and allowing patients to continue to have access to IVF.
Yeah, and you've mentioned that kind of throughout of how you wear many different hats. Even in a day, it sounds like you're taking off patient hat, putting on teacher hat. I'm wondering if you could talk more about some of those other roles and how specifically being a mentor factors into your work.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of what has kept me in an academic setting is because I like the variety. And I like the variety of each thing for different reasons. From a mentoring perspective, it's pretty awesome when someone that was your med student is now faculty at another academic REI division. And that has happened now. There are a handful of people that were my medical students that work as practicing REIs, which is pretty cool. And similarly, med students keep us young and excited. So it's nice to have a daily interaction with individuals that have a fresh, excited perspective and people that have aged a bit. I just by nature am someone who enjoys multitasking and I personally find it boring to do the same thing over and over again. So it's fun for me to have lots of different things and areas of interest working in parallel and at the same time.
How do you avoid burnout when you're juggling all these different things?
Some of it is related to actually finding joy in all of these things. I am reaching a point where most of the things I do them because I enjoy them, not because I feel obliged. I also think, as with anything, it's important to have boundaries and to know what brings you joy and to be able to say no to things that don't bring you joy and that aren't necessarily necessary. It's not to say that everything you do in life has to bring you joy, right? But as we get older, we can maybe be more selective in what we choose to do or not choose to do. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I also have 2 children that are like the light of my life. And so I have boundaries in terms of what I accept or don't accept or when I travel and don't travel, knowing that honestly, my first priority is my kids and my family. So as much as I have gone on and on about work and all the things I like about work, I will openly admit to anybody that my family is my first priority. And I think being happy at home makes it easier to also be happy at work. They go hand in hand, but I think am also very lucky in that the field of REI is one in which you can have a good balance between time that is spent at work and time that is spent doing other things that bring you joy.
Amazing to hear that you're able to balance a career that you love with a family that you're also able to fully love in the way that you want it. That's amazing. I'm wondering if you had any advice either regarding how to balance these things or more broadly for trainees who are interested in this field, any general advice that you'd like to offer to people as they progress throughout their career?
I honestly think that if you find a field or something that you're passionate about, you can get creative over how you build your schedule and how you make it work depending on what your priorities are. But the first piece of the whole puzzle is some introspection and self-evaluation about what brings each individual joy, right? For every person, that's different. And you have to think of your decisions in life as a piece of this pie and this puzzle. And so even when looking for a job, someone has to say, is it money that gives me happiness? Is it time that gives me happiness? Is it flexibility? You know, there's a handful of things and you can't have 100% of everything. And so it's a balance of which of those aspects fill my cup to what degree and how do I balance them? And it might be that you get paid less, but you have more time to yourself. And that makes the whole work out. And I think there's a big amount of intentionality about understanding what are one's own priorities and what are the aspects in one's life that bring them the most joy. And for every individual, that is so different. And it can be a matter of where you live. It can be a matter of how much control you have over your schedule. It can be a matter of what time of day your day starts or ends, or how many extra meetings you're willing to add, or how much travel you do. But for many fields, if you're willing to be flexible on different portions of it, if you know which portion is your priority, you can oftentimes find a way to find a balance. But it has to be a realistic idea. Like, you can't say, I want to get paid tons and tons of money, but I want to work 2 days a week. Okay, that's going to be really hard to find. So you have to be realistic in expectations, but also sometimes creative.
That is great advice. I think I can speak for myself and for Megan and probably tons of listeners. We really appreciate that advice. We would love to just switch gears and talk a little bit about just some fun facts about you. So we've heard that you're an avid runner. What are your other hobbies and interests outside of medicine?
Yeah, I am an avid runner. I wake up at, I don't even know, 5:30 every day and either run or bike. And I have been doing that, honestly, since I stopped playing field hockey, which is what I played at Davidson. And I enjoy traveling with my family. We do a fair amount of international travel, which is really fun to see the world through the eyes of children, to cities that they haven't been to in the past, and experiencing other cultures that are different than ours. And honestly, I'm at a phase in my life where a lot of my downtime is spent watching youth sports.
Amazing. This can be either work or non-work related, but I'm wondering if you have a particular accomplishment that you're most proud of that you'd like to share.
It's going to sound cliche, but honestly, it's my kids. They're amazing humans, and I hope to do everything I can to keep them on the trajectory that they are currently on.
That's so wonderful to hear. And then last question that we always ask all of our guests, do you have a favorite song that you like to play in the OR?
Gosh, no, I don't always play the same song. I think I change it up. During embryo transfers, I actually let patients pick the song, and I bring my little Bluetooth speaker into the OR and I let the patients pick, which is actually fun because sometimes they introduce me to singer-songwriters that I otherwise would not have listened to.
Dr. Kuwas, thank you so much for joining us today for another episode of Wiser. We loved hearing about your life, your career. We're so excited for our listeners to get to know you better as well.
Thank you so much for having me. I love that y'all are doing this.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Wiser. If you like this episode, please rate and leave a review as it helps others find the show. You can also share with friends and family. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Wiser Podcast for updates. This episode was hosted by Megan Lawson and Rachel Holstein. Production and editing support comes from Grace Wynn. Music and editing software courtesy of Descript.